Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
So, how was your Sunday? Because the NFL Sunday was unreal. Patrick Mahomes, Ryan Fitzpatrick, the Jacksonville Jaguars, and a Buffalo Bills player retiring at halftime. All of that happened and in a matter of hours, and it's only week two. It's not even October, and this season is already straight fire. But there was so much from yesterday, I'm not even sure where to start. But I can start you with a question. How about those Chiefs?
Hey, how about those Chiefs?
About those Chiefs. How about that Patrick Mahomes? When Kansas City was willing to move Alex Smith and give the team to Mahomes, after one start, the expectations were already through the roof, but they still were not high enough because Mahomes is smashing expectations, smashing records, and smashing secondaries. Week one, 256 yards, four touchdowns against the Chargers. Yesterday, 23 of 28, 326 yards, six touchdowns. Yes, I said it. Six touchdowns. Go ahead, Alvy. Roll it.
Patrick Mahomes empties the backfield. Mahomes firing for Kelce this time. Caught. No, it's Conley's got the touchdown. Touchdown, Kansas City. Mahomes comfortable throws for Kelce. Adjusts his route, makes the catch, and rolls into the end zone. Touchdown, Kansas City. On two rolls of the dice, the Chiefs roll seven. Mahomes takes it, dumps it to Hunt. Near side at the five, trying to drag a defender into the end zone. He's got a touchdown, Kansas City.
In the empty backfield, Mahomes steps up down the middle of the field. Caught by Kelce. Touchdown, Kansas City. A perfect low post throw.
Roll out to the right side, Mahomes. He fires it late, and the pass is going to be caught. Are they going to give it to him?
The rule of the field is changed to a touchdown.
Mahomes throwing left sideline. Pass is caught, Tyreek Hill. Touchdown, Kansas City. Mahomes stays hot.
But folks, all he does is throw touchdown passes.
Everybody into the pattern. Touchdown, Kansas City. My thanks to Chiefs Radio for that. These guys are insane. I mean, they're unreal. You combine Mahomes with Andy Reid's offense and all those weapons, and what you have is an absolute nightmare. That's an NFL record, 10 touches in the first two games, and he did it against the Steelers and the Chargers, a couple of legitimate Super Bowl contenders. Now, nobody gives out an MVP award after only 2 weeks, but if they did, Mahomes would be right there to take it. And the only reason it's not a lock is because of this little thing called Fitz magic. 417 yards and four touchdowns in week one against the Saints. He chases that 402 yards and four touchdowns in week two against the Eagles. Ryan freaking Fitzpatrick, if you need him, and the Bucks do, because what they don't need right now is Jameis Winston. I mean, can you honestly imagine if Ryan Fitzpatrick in his 14th season, the ultimate journeyman, right? What if that guy ripped the starting job from Jameis Winston? Harvard v. Heisman. Be like the best story ever. Speaking of that, did you know that Ryan Fitzpatrick played college football at a school in Boston? Little known fact. Just wanted to get that out there in case you didn't know. What's also a little known fact, well, isn't a little known fact, is that Jameis Winston is still out for one more game. But you can't give this guy's job back the moment he comes back. Not the way Fitzpatrick is playing. Maybe guys don't lose their job to injuries, but they can lose their job to suspensions. And he better. He should. Who would bench a guy with back-to-back 400-yard games? Who would bench a guy who, if we lived in some bizarre world where the NFL did play a two-game season, he would be your MVP? And if Fitzpatrick is not the MVP, then his podium outfit was ripped straight from DeSean Jackson, and he was killing it.
Hey, DJ. I got like two more because DJ needs his stuff back.
Wait a minute, you mean this?
I borrowed your stuff. Sorry. Yeah, I borrowed your stuff. Sorry, DeSean.
This dude. This dude.
The chest hair is mine.
The chest hair is mine. Yes, he has to give the clothes back, but no way he gives that job back. Not if he continues to play anywhere near close to the way he has right now. Absolutely amazing. on and off the field. And if week two ended right there, it would have been great, but it didn't, because we still had the Pats and the Jags in the AFC title game rematch, and the Jacksonville Jaguars absolutely torched the Patriots. There was no awe. There was no intimidation. Just check that first quarter catch from Keenan Cole.
Safety down. One safety back in the middle.
First and 15. And what a catch! Oh, wow! Velcroed by Cole for 22 yards.
Oh, my God. That's the best catch easily this year. You can go back here. That's Odell Beckham right there. Look at that. And then keep it away from Rowe. I got it, and now let me bring it away from you.
Hey, listen, never mind best catch of the year. I think that's the best catch I've ever seen in my life. I think that literally is the best catch I have ever seen in my entire life. 21-3 at halftime. 24-3 halfway through the third quarter. They were this close to humiliating the Patriots. Nobody does that. They end up settling for a 31-20 win. 31-20, but don't let that final score fool you. They didn't just beat New England. They dominated New England. They beat them down. They beat them up, and they did it without Leonard Fournette. They did it in every facet of that game. Blake Bortles outplayed TB12. Yes, I said it, and you saw it. Bortles outplayed Brady. The Jags secondary shut down Gronk. Yeah, he said it. Quote, they did a good job overall. I just have to watch the film, how they did it. They've got good players. I have to play better. They did a good job. They're a good team. End quote. Gronk, 2 catches, 15 yards, complete non-factor. And the Jags didn't do it with smoke and mirrors and tricks. They bullied him, with Tayshaun Gibson doing most of the bullying. Yet, remember how they were criticized for being so cautious offensively in the AFC Championship game? Not yesterday. Yesterday, they were aggressive, even with a lead. They let Blake Bortles win that game for them. I said that too. They let Bortles win that game for them, and he did. Because that Blake Bortles was good. He had his own defense's attention. That's how good he was. Calais Campbell said, quote, I was grabbing popcorn. Every time he was with the ball in his hands, I was like, he's about to do something great. And then he's running and spinning. It was impressive. End quote. When has anybody ever said, every time Blake Bortles had the football in his hand, he was about to do something great? Never. But he did. He was that good. He was that good. That wasn't just impressive. That wasn't just good. That was Super Bowl good. Blake Bortles plays like that, and the Jags don't just get to the Super Bowl, they win the Super Bowl. Jacksonville did not just look legit, they look like the defending AFC champs. While the actual defending AFC champs were getting screamed at on the sideline by Brady. Look, there's no such thing as a statement game in mid-September, but that was a statement game in mid-September. Statement being, the Jags are not a fluke. They're not a one-off. The Jags are not here to take part. The Jags are here to take over. Duval! They looked awesome. That was really impressive. We are joined by NFL Network analyst James Jones. James, great to have you on. Good morning. How are you?
I'm good, my man. How you doing?
Good, good. Good to visit with you. Going into yesterday's Vikings-Packers game, let me start right there. The biggest question was, would Aaron Rodgers play? Now, you played with him. You're good friends with him. You guaranteed that he was going to play. What made you so sure he'd go yesterday?
Oh, man, like you said, I played with him, man, for 8 years, man. So I've seen this dude just battle through injuries, man, not only through the game, but through practice, too, man. He's one of those guys to where, if he has injuries, he doesn't even like missing practice, you know. So I've seen him battling out there with hamstrings injuries and still not sitting on the training room, coming out there practicing. And he knows that when he shows that type of toughness, it rubs off on his teammates. We out here to win. Everybody's going to be hurt. We're going through a season with a pretty brutal game. We're going to be hurt. So I've seen him play hurt through practice. So I knew, man, this is game time. Aaron ain't missing no game time no matter what.
Who you got in Monday Night Football clones? You do not have to wait until tomorrow to tell me. You can tell my bookie right now. Do you want to take it to the next level? Then you've got to get down. And no better place to get down than with my bookie. Trust me, they are the best bet this season. They've been in business for years. They have great reviews online, and their mobile site is very easy to navigate. Lay down some cash, win big right now. I would only recommend a service to my listeners that's been good to me. This is why I'm urging you to make your way to MyBookie. You win, they pay. And they have in-game live betting, the most rewarding player perks in the business. And for you fantasy guys out there, you can even bet the over-under on how many fantasy points a player will score each game. Join now and MyBookie will match your deposit dollar for dollar. Use the promo code ROME to activate that offer. A dollar for dollar match on your deposit? That is some serious ROI before you even hit the digital window. Visit MyBookie online today. That's MyBookie. Do not forget to use the promo code ROME when creating your account to get that bonus. You play, you win, you get paid. James Jones joining us. I'm glad you brought that up. I was going to say that he doesn't miss practice. So if you're that guy, if you're one of the best to ever spin it and you're banged up and you know nobody's going to say anything at all if this guy misses a practice, but if he's out there grinding the way he does and never misses practice, what kind of a message does it send to everybody else in that locker room?
Oh, it's huge, man. I think, and I truly believe that's why he does it, because he knows he's the leader of that ball club. So if I'm out here and I sit down with little nicks and bruises, everybody else gonna sit down with nicks and bruises. But if my teammates see me out here hurting, battling through injuries, and I'm still practicing because I still want to get better and I am the greatest quarterback of all time, that's gonna rub off on them. And they're going to go out there and they're going to grind through their injuries and they're going to practice. And as a team, that's how you get better. Because trust me, after the very first day of training camp, ain't nobody 100%.
Right.
We're battling through little injuries all year long. So let's grind through it. Let's get better. Let's not let them set us back. And when you see your leader doing that, it rubs off on the team.
NFL Network analyst James Jones joining us. So you might be biased, but if I had to ask you, is he the best you've ever seen to do it? And if so, if you had to boil it down to one thing, what makes him so different and so special?
Well, I tell people all the time, in my humble opinion, he's the greatest to ever do it. And it's not just because I played with him. I truly go off the product on the field. I'm not a stats guy. So I don't say, oh, this guy got the most Super Bowl rings. This guy got the most rushing yards. He's the best. When I think of greatest running backs, I don't think of Emmitt Smith because he has the most rushing yards. I think of Barry Sanders because Barry did stuff on the field that we've never seen before. And we all wanted to do it. We all wanted to be like Barry. Aaron Rodgers is like Barry Sanders. He does stuff that we've never seen before. When any quarterback is getting compared to a guy in the National Football League, they're comparing him to Aaron Rodgers because he's the best. We've never seen it before. We've never seen throws like this out the pocket. We've never seen throws like this in the pocket. Some of the things that he does on the field, his product that he puts on the field, is the best we've ever seen, in my opinion.
James Jones, NFL Network analyst, joining us. All right, you played 9 years in the NFL, as I mentioned. You've been covering the league ever since then. So what was your reaction to Bills corner Vontae Davis retiring at halftime? Have you ever seen or heard anything like that?
I've never seen or heard anything like that. I mean, I understand that you probably get the feeling, you know, that, you know, I'm done playing, you know, shoot, this is my time, but I never think you should make a decision just off of emotions. You know what I mean? And to me, at the halftime of a game, your emotions is just running high. Just relax, calm down a little bit, take a day, wake up in the morning. If you're still feeling like that, then do it. But don't just go in the locker room at halftime and then with all your emotions running high, you might be playing bad, your body might be hurting, and then you just make a decision like that. So I've never seen that before. But to me, it's just an emotional decision. I wish he would have just relaxed, got on that plane ride home, sat down, maybe talked to his wife and kids or something, and be like, okay, I'm done.
James Jones joining us. So what do you think? You think ultimately he's going to look back and regret that he did that? Or do you think he's going to be at peace with that decision and it's going to be fine?
I don't know, because when I retired, I was at peace with my decision. So he could have been thinking about this a little while before it all went down and, you know, said I'm done, and we'll look back on this like, man, I'm glad I did it. And then he could look back on it and say, man, why'd I do that, man? I had a couple more years left in me, man. My emotions was riding high. I was mad at myself for playing bad. Injuries was getting to me, and I wish I could go out there and play a couple more years. So he could be looking at that too. So only he knows.
He's an NFL Network analyst. He played 9 years in the NFL. We're talking to James Jones for a few more moments. So the Browns are going to move on from Josh Gordon, and the expectation is he may be traded possibly by 4 p.m. Eastern today. Man, you know, this guy, talk about a different guy. He's got a ton of talent, but if the Browns are ready to move on from him, I think that does tell you something. If you're another team, would you bring him in or would you trade for him?
I absolutely would trade for him if I was another team, like the Dallas Cowboys. Any of these teams that really need a big-time wide receiver, because we all know if he's healthy, if his head is in the right spot, he's one of the best in the game. And if you can get him for a seventh-round pick and get him for, you know, veteran minimum, whatever he's playing for this year, and you get a talent like that, I don't think you could pass on it. Yeah, I know it's hit or miss because, okay, he could get in trouble and have a setback and, you know, not play at all. But if he doesn't, you just got a diamond in the rough, because this is one of the guys that can really destroy this league if he is healthy and his mind is right. So if I'm one of those teams, I'm willing to take that chance just because what I've seen Josh Gordon do on that football field when he is healthy.
James Jones, my guest. All right, now these two guys I'm going to mention, they could not be more different. They could not go about it more differently. But who's been more impressive so far, Patrick Mahomes or Ryan Fitzpatrick?
Ooh, that's a good one right there. I'm going to have to say Patrick Mahomes, because, I mean, we've seen Ryan Fitzpatrick in spurts kind of play like this. You know what I mean? Yeah, he's going crazy, and, you know, the first two games. But 10 touchdowns in the first 2 weeks, and some of the throws that I've seen this kid make, sidearm, outside the pocket, he looks like a guy that I just said was the GOAT. And Aaron Rodgers, but the ball is just coming off his hands, flick of the wrist. I mean, all the playmakers he has out there, he's getting the ball into their hands. But 10 touchdowns in 2 weeks, I mean, that's something that you can't look past. I can't say Fitzpatrick is playing better than him right now, just because, I mean, that's something that people don't do.
Yeah, because that's something you just don't see. We've never seen that before. Now, you called your shot earlier this month that Khalil Mack would not only be or would not be the defensive player of the year, but he'd be the MVP. Knowing how much respect then that you have for him and his game, what did you think of that decision to trade him?
Oh, man. Well, obviously, being a Raider and playing with Khalil Mack, I mean, I did not like it. I mean, you're giving away a pass rusher that probably is the best in the game. I mean, if they said, here, you can have Von Miller or Khalil Mack, you're not mad at none of those. You're like, thank you. You know, so, and then as for a Raiders team who doesn't have a pass rush, who was dependent on this guy to get after the quarterback, who is the best player on the team, and you trade him away, I did not like it. And time waits to see how, you know, this trade is going to play out, because Gruden could go out there and draft two number one draft picks, and they could be ballers, and we could be looking back and saying Gruden's a genius because he drafted these two guys when he traded Khalil Mack. But right now, where we stand right now, I think it was absolutely ridiculous, because he's the best player on your team. He's always there. He's always going to get after the quarterback. He never fought the battle with any injuries or like that. He's always available, and you let him go.
All right, I got about a minute left. I wanted to hit you with so many more things, but I want to ask you about this. September 29th, you're recognized for your induction into the San Jose State Sports Hall of Fame. You've done a lot of things athletically. How much, though, are you looking forward to that, and what's the honor mean to you?
Man, when I – all my years playing football, I always used to tell my teammates, man, that beyond the stats, beyond anything else, you play this game for respect, and you play it for respect from your teammates, respect from your peers, and that's why you play this game. I mean, I know people love the money and all that, but to me, people play this game for respect. You want people to respect what you have done on that football field and in the community. And when I got the call from San Jose State, and they told me, it was just a sign of respect, like, dang, okay, they respected what I've done, not only on the football field, but off the field, how I represented the university, and that means a lot to me, man. Respect is everything.
You've got the Bills. Now, let me start by saying I hate it when bad things happen to good people. And the 2018 Bills are a bad thing happening to some very good people. Bills fans, Bills players, the city of Buffalo. Bad things happening to good people. We're just two games into the season, and it already feels like the Bills are the new Browns. not just because they lost 31-20 at home to the Chargers, but because bad does not begin to describe what happened yesterday. Sure, there was the fact that they fell behind 28-3 in the second quarter at home. There were dumb moves on special teams. There was the head coach, Sean McDermott, ripping the play calling duties from defensive coordinator Leslie Frazier. But that wasn't even the strangest or biggest or worst thing that happened at halftime. Because that's when Bills cornerback Vontae Davis quit. Retired. Wait, what? McDermott said Davis, quote, pulled himself out of the game.
So he communicated to us that he was done.
I mean, what's that mean? Done for the game? No. Done for the season? Nope. Done for good. Like, done, done. It's one thing when you're losing at halftime. It's another thing when one of your players just bails, just bounces, just up and quits. Now, a little background. Davis was signed by the Bills in February. In June, he tweeted a pic of himself in a Bills uniform with the caption, "Suit up. Not long now. Hashtag Bills Mafia." I guess what he meant was, I won't be suited up for long now. Hey, look, I want to make something really clear before I continue. And this is why I think I'm different than a lot of other people you may watch or you may listen to. Let's be real for a minute, okay? I never played football. I only have a small, small idea of the physical and psychological toll that it must take on a human being to do that week in and week out for years of your life. So it would be extremely easy for me to sit in a plush, air-conditioned studio in Southern California and try to get all fire with it by saying, hey, that's not retiring, that's quitting. And then yell about how Vontae Davis is a quitter and scream about how you got to be mentally tough to play this game, that it's a man's game. You know, come on, Vontae, when life hands you lemons, quit. And when the going gets tough, the tough quit. Listen, I don't know what was going on in Davis's head yesterday, but I know this, it wasn't good. It was really, really bad. And it sure seems like something must have snapped. Because this isn't like boxing where guys sit on a stool and they don't come out for another round. That happens. We see that. This, on the other hand, never happens. We never see this. Last night, Davis released a statement where he laid out his reasons for walking away. It all seems kind of legit. They all seem like pretty good reasons. If we had heard them in the offseason or during a bye week or even midweek, but mid-game? You couldn't just make it through the second half. Say that you got an injury. Stand on the sideline with your teammates. Maybe sleep on it. Think it over. Talk about it with the guys in the secondary room. Or just walk out while they're getting treatment and talking about the game plan for the second half. Again, I've got no idea what this guy's going through. But his teammates do. They were taking the same beating on the field that he was, and they were not impressed that he quit on them. Again, I don't want to call him a quitter, but then again, I don't have to because they're doing it for me and the teammates carry a lot more weight than I do. Rafael Bush said, quote, I did lose a little respect for him just as a man. In this game, we're always taught to fight until the end. For you to give up on your teammates like that in the middle of a game, I've just never seen anything like that, end quote. Actually, he wasn't done. He went on to say, quote, those are some of the things that are just inexcusable. As a man and as a player that's been playing for a long time, it's a pride thing. You don't just quit on your teammates like that, end quote. So how do you do that? Did he just say, hey, I'm good? Did he say, I've got to get something from the car? And then just go out to the parking lot, drive off, and not come back? Well, according to The Athletic, quote, at halftime, Davis, 30, took his uniform off, put on his street clothes, and left the stadium. This dude just up and bounced. Got dressed and left. I mean, that's incredible. I have never heard anything like that. Never heard anything like that, and neither had his teammates. Defensive tackle Kyle Williams. You're not going to find a more respected guy than that. Williams said, quote, I've never been around that. Never heard anything like that. I think the only thing to say is he's where he needs to be right now, end quote. And when somebody said to Williams, where's that? He said, quote, that's not here. Point blank and simple. That guy is where he needs to be right now, which is not here with us. Lorenzo Alexander might have been the most bent of all. Another solid, solid, heady vet. Again, I'm not going to call Vontae Davis a quitter. I don't need to. Alexander did for me. Quote, I'm going to show him more respect than he showed us as far as quitting on us in the middle of the game. And he had more.
You've seen anything like that in your NFL
career? Never have seen it ever. Pop Warner, high school, college, pros, never heard of it, never seen it. And it's just completely disrespectful to his teammates.
Did he say anything to you? Did he
say anybody did?
He didn't say nothing to nobody.
He left?
When did he find out? You know as much as I know. I know I found out going in the second half of the game. Coming out, they said he's not coming out, he retired. So.
What?
Yep. That's it. So
who said what? Who said he?
Sean said
guys on the sideline. I mean, guys heard about it and said that he wasn't coming back out.
All right, quickly, as they go to break, notice that these guys in the locker room are not saying, hey, y'all, you have no idea. You have no idea what we go through. You have no idea what it's like. You don't judge. You don't know. They're not saying that at all. They're saying this guy quit. This guy quit on us, and we have never seen anything like that, but now he's in a better place, and that better place is anywhere but here. They're bent. Very busy man, as always. Chris Mannix is my guest. Chris, good morning. How are you?
I'm good, Jim. How you doing, man?
Great, bud. Great. Great to have you back. Thanks for doing this. Now, you've had a couple of days to think about it, Chris. So, what did you make of what you saw on Saturday between Canelo and Triple G?
I still think the same thing I felt immediately after that last belt. You know, terrific fight, evenly matched guys. I scored the fight for Golovkin by a couple of points, 7-5 for Gennady. But as that final bell rang, Jim, I said to myself, I'd be okay with a draw or 15-13 the other way. Anything beyond that, I would have scratched my head out a little bit. And sure enough, we had one judge with a draw and, you know, two other very good judges, including Steve Weisfeld, who I think is, you know, arguably the best judge in boxing, had it 15-13 for Canelo. I mean, Canelo Alvarez, he earned that win. He took the fight to Gennady Golovkin. He landed the heavier shots. He was out-jabbed. He was out-landed, but these are imperfect statistics. I had no problem with the decision going as something different than what I had on my card.
Chris Mannix joining us. All right, you pointed out that going into that fight, the big question was about Canelo and conditioning. Before we get into Canelo's strategy in the fight, how impressed were you with his conditioning and the fact, Chris, that in the middle rounds, it seemed like it was Triple G who was fading and not Alvarez?
Yeah, incredibly impressed because, look, this was not only a big moment for Canelo's career, but to many people, including myself to some degree, it was going to be a referendum on his status as a clean fighter. I mean, if he had gone out there and been gassed early and gotten knocked out, I think his entire career would have been tainted. I think we would have been talking about, well, he tested positive here. He had to be doing it before. This was a guy that was unquestionably clean for this fight, that was the better conditioned fighter for 12 rounds. I didn't see a single lull, you know, outside of maybe a 10-second spurt here or there when he got hit, you know, for Canelo Alvarez. So his conditioning was flawless for this fight. And this is what I asked his trainers afterwards, and they said they weren't even worried about the conditioning. They were just focused on other things like power shots because they wanted to back Golovkin up.
Couldn't have been more impressed with his conditioning, but then there's the strategy. Chris Mannix, my guest. What do you make of the strategy from the first fight and how Alvarez's team completely changed it up for the rematch?
A brilliant strategy. And I've been pretty critical over the years of Canelo's trainers, Chepo and Eddie Reynoso. It goes back to what I saw against Floyd Mayweather. You remember that fight? It was one of the worst strategies I've ever seen in boxing. You know, they had a guy physically bigger than Floyd Mayweather, and their strategy for 12 rounds was to try to box him on the outside. I couldn't have been more disappointed in that strategy, and I believe I suggested at the time that, you know, at 23 years old, Canelo needs to change up his training team. Now, Canelo is fiercely loyal to these guys, and they really showed their value in this fight. I mean, nobody believed that Canelo was going to stand there and trade punches with Golovkin. I asked Tom Loeffler, the promoter, immediately after the fight. I said, how surprised are you? He said, extremely. We thought he was going to move. We thought he was going to fight up the ropes. He fought a completely different style, and that's a variable in all this, Jim, because, you know, they made a great adjustment in Canelo's corner to fight this way. I don't think, and I didn't see any kind of real adjustment from Golovkin's corner to adjust to what they were seeing.
Chris Mannix, my guest. I want to be very clear about this, Chris. Not only did I not see that coming, that switch in strategy, I'm kind of blown away by it. I mean, there's his physical conditioning, then there's his mental strength, but the willingness to take a punch from a guy, Chris, that nobody ever wants to take a punch from, what did that tell you about Canelo, that he stood right in front of Triple G?
I mean, he must have learned something in that first fight about his chin. And his chin, Jim, has been a point of contention for really the last 8 years. Now, he's fought some good opponents and, you know, never been stopped by any stretch. However, you go back 8 years when he was on the undercard of one of Floyd Mayweather's shows, and he was fighting this journeyman named Jose Miguel Cotto. It was actually Miguel Cotto's older brother. He fought Cotto in that fight. He got rocked in the first round, knocked back against the ropes, almost stopped in that fight, which would have completely changed his career. Since then, you know, there's been some questions about whether this guy has a chin, but whatever happened in that first fight, whatever shots he took, he clearly realized, his trainers realized, that he could walk through all that stuff, that Golovkin, as big and bad as he was, just couldn't hurt him. And if they had that kind of knowledge under their belts, that strategy was as good as it gets.
Chris Mannix, my guest. All right, we talked about Canelo and what that fight meant to him, not only in terms of his career, but his entire reputation. If his reputation, Chris, was on the line going into that fight, what does Triple G's career look like coming out of the fight? Again, a really close fight. If the couple of judges scored a different way in the 12th round, we have a different outcome. Is it only one loss, because it's his first loss? Is it only one loss, or does it set up some questions about Triple G and his career? And do we now question whether or not he is one of the all-time greats with that loss?
I do think that you have to kind of take a step back from the all-time great conversation when it comes to Golovkin. He just doesn't have a signature win on that resume. Now, I say that with the full understanding that there were some of the top middleweights, even super middleweights, that were running as fast as possible to get away from him over the last 5 years. His inability to get a top flight opponent has everything to do with all the other top opponents, including Canelo, who spent a year plus avoiding that fight as he kind of matured into a middleweight, and I think waited for Golovkin to age a little bit. So I think we take a step back from anointing Golovkin in that kind of Hagler class, the Hopkins class of the great middleweights of their of boxing's history, but I don't know that it diminishes him as a surefire Hall of Famer. I don't know if it diminishes him as one of the great middleweight champions in terms of, you know, obviously the 20 title defenses of all time. It just it knocks him off that pedestal of being among the all-time greats.
All right, but do you think he won that first fight? And if he gets credit for winning that first fight, is he on that pedestal with the other greats?
He probably is. I had a draw the first fight, Jim. I thought the middle rounds were all Golovkin, and the first three and the last three were Canelo Alvarez, largely through the conditioning issues that we talked about a little bit earlier. So, yeah, if he wins that first fight, you know, it obviously sets up a natural trilogy, which we'll probably see anyway. And yeah, maybe you do look at his career a little bit differently. But he's been plagued by the fact that, you know, besides Canelo Alvarez, who's out there in the middleweight division that makes you excited, that opponent that you get excited to see Golovkin face? I mean, look, guys, you know, the top-ranked guys promoted Manny Pacquiao for years will tell you that, you know, Pacquiao benefited so greatly from being in a weight class of other superstars, from the Miguel Cotos, the Margaritos, to De La Hoya, to Mayweather. He had a factory line of opponents that he could fight on any given night. Gennady Golovkin just has never had that cluster of opponents that could make him a star.
You mentioned Pacquiao, Chris. Is there a worse idea than Pacquiao Mayweather again?
I don't know. Like Pacquiao me is probably a worse idea, but other than that, I don't know.
I'd rather see that, my friend.
I have no interest, Jim. And look, I'll be honest. I mean, I don't think it's going to happen. I mean, this is – look, it's no surprise that Floyd puts out a post like that on the day that Canelo Alvarez, who fights under Oscar De La Hoya's banner, is having a card. Anything to draw attention away from De La Hoya and stick it to De La Hoya again, Floyd Mayweather's going to do. I mean, you know, Pacquiao, look, there's a million reasons why this fight will probably never happen. One of the more, you know, reasonable ones is the fact that Pacquiao, I think, is like $32 million in debt to the IRS, and, you know, he's never going to fight in the U.S. again. And Mayweather, for the last decade plus, has been fighting in Las Vegas every single time. So among the many reasons why that fight's never going to happen is that Pacquiao will probably never fight in the U.S. again.
Good. good, because I think that I would rather fight either one of them myself than watch the two of them fight each other. I think I'd rather fight both of them at the same time than watch the two of them fight each other and pay for it.
I don't think you have to worry about it either.
Thank you.
I mean, Floyd, I was talking to someone that would know about this, and he was telling me that this hasn't even come up in a real conversation in any talks they've had with Floyd. And I think Pacquiao is likely to get in with Amir Khan at some point, either before the end of the year or early next year. That's a fight for him that makes way too much sense. I mean, Khan needs a big-name opponent. He can sell out a stadium in the U.K., so there's no tax issue in the U.S. And I think a Khan-Pacquiao fight right now is a 50-50 type of fight that both guys should be running towards.
Good. Chris Mannix, senior writer for Yahoo Sports, covering the NBA and boxing, also a host for DAZN, which has Anthony Joshua, a heavyweight title fight this Saturday from London. Great job, Chris. Thank you so much. Always good to have you on.
Anytime, Jim.
And we're talking about week two in the NFL. Meantime, I want to say that the Buffalo Bills are the new Cleveland Browns, except the current Cleveland Browns absolutely refuse to relinquish that title. Last week, they had one chance after another to beat the Steelers, and they would not. Even down to this field goal attempt in overtime. You hit this, you win the game, you change the entire narrative and the way people see you. Roll it.
Here comes the field goal team, and listen to this stadium. Gonzalez is ready. Kulig will snap. Snap is back. Ball down. Kick on the way. It got blocked. The Steelers blocked the kick, and it never had a prayer.
Nope. Never, ever had a chance. Never had a prayer. BGB. BGB. Brown's gonna brown. But that went to another level when they announced that they were parting ways with Josh Gordon. Now that sucks. Not just for Browns fans, but just in general, because it sounded like there was a possibility that he had, in fact, turned his life around and that he was doing the work and that he was winning that battle. But if the Browns are dumping Gordon, that tells me a lot of that is not happening, because the Browns have made it pretty clear they are not in the position to be giving up on talent, much less that talent, no matter how many issues they have. They were willing to give him one chance after another. So if they're giving up on Gordon, that sure makes it seem like there's something very wrong. And that's not what you want to be doing before you take on Drew Brees and the Saints in New Orleans. I mean, that seemed like they were primed for a blowout. But the blowout never happened because the Browns' defense showed up huge again. And then in the fourth quarter, on 4th and 5, with just over a minute left in the game, 4th and 5 now, Cleveland down 6. Tyrod Taylor dialed up some magic.
4th down and 5 out of the shotgun. He's got the snap. He's backpedaling up in the pocket, throwing long and deep for Callaway. He caught it in the end zone. Touchdown, Antonio Callaway. What a catch.
That is an absolutely unbelievable play. That play right there is why I'm one of the only people that continues to take up for this guy. This is why I always say he does not get nearly the respect that he deserves. Taylor. I'm not surprised by that play. This guy has got unbelievable stones. I mean, what a ball that was he threw. 4th and 5, perfect pass in the end zone, touchdown, tie game, 18-18. Thanks for coming. Did his job. Unfortunately, the kicker did not do his job, because all they needed was an extra point to take the lead and steal that game in New Orleans.
As Britton Coquit wanted it reset, now it's at 3. Gonzalez for the extra point. Snap back, ball down, the kick is up, and he missed it again! Zane Gonzalez misses the extra point again!
That's
with a
in
minute
his head.
16 left.
You think? That's in his head, you think? Missed a couple of field goals, missed a couple of extra points. They have a chance to go into New Orleans and rip that game. He saw Tyrod Taylor throw an unbelievable ball on 4th and 5, and he missed the point after. I mean, damn. To quote that legendary Browns fan, oh my God, this is not happening. Oh my God, this is not happening. Oh my God. Oh my God. Unfortunately, it is. It is. Again, BGB. Browns, gonna brown. I mean, how many times can the Browns, I'm really serious about this, how many times can the Browns do the most Browns thing ever? How many times? How often can the Browns do the most Browns things ever? Every week, every play? Even LeBron was stunned by that completion to Callaway and then the butchered extra point. Are you kidding me on the extra point, Joe? Nope. Nope. Sadly, LeBron, nobody's kidding. That happened. I mean, what could be more Browns than to tie that game the way they did on fourth down and then miss the PAT? How about tying that game on fourth down, missing the extra point, and then giving up a 42-yard pass two plays later to let the Saints get into field goal range? Because that's exactly what they did too. But they still weren't done. The Saints hit that field goal to go up three with 21 seconds left. But Taylor and the Browns wouldn't go down. Taylor to Jarvis Landry, 25. That gets him to midfield. Taylor hits Antonio Callaway, 16 yards. He gets out of bounds. I mean, at that point, a totally composed, totally professional drive to get into field goal range at the New Orleans 34. In other words, that was the least Browns thing ever, and now they've got a shot to tie it. Send this thing into overtime with a field goal. Maybe get this thing back. Rip it back. It was right there for them.
21-18, New Orleans. Snap is back. Ball is down. He's into it. End over end. The kick is no good. With 3 seconds to go. And Gonzalez, with his helmet off, takes the long walk over to the Browns bench area again.
At least it was close. And by the way, bro, I would not be taking your helmet off. Not after a game like that. Of course he missed that kick. Because after missing the extra point, there was no way he was going to hit that field goal. Hitting that field goal would have meant that the Browns are no longer the Browns. Let me reiterate that point. Hitting that field goal would have meant the Browns are no longer the Browns anymore, but they are still the Browns. And because they are still the Browns gonna brown no matter what. BGB. BGB. Browns gonna brown for life. How's that gonna change? Jeff Perlman is in studio. My man, how you living, Jeff?
I'm grinding.
Yeah, you are.
I'm grinding. It's not like writing a Brett Favre book or promoting a Brett Favre book or a Walter Payton book. It's a totally different monster. But it's good. It's a challenge.
Okay, I'm going to ask you about that. I can't wait to get the answer to that question. But I do want to ask you about this because you tweeted about this yesterday. And I want to ask you right off the top. You have covered sports for the better part of two decades. Have you ever seen anybody retire at halftime the way Vontae Davis did? And what do you make of the reaction from his teammate, Lorenzo Alexander?
I kind of thought good for him for staying. It was refreshing. It wasn't political. It was refreshing. I think it's crazy. I've never seen that. To just walk off and just like, I'm done.
Sure.
Like, pretend you're hurt and stay on the sideline. Do something. You know, like something. I thought, cross the line.
Hey, look, I said the same thing. Pretend you're hurt, stay on the sideline, think it over. Hey, look, and I want to be very clear about this. I'm sitting in an air-conditioned studio in Southern California, having never worn a helmet before, so I'm not going to be the guy to say, you're a quitter, you didn't retire. Right. But I had his teammates to say that for me. I didn't have to.
Right, I agree with you. I mean, it kind of reminded me of Mike Tyson sort of quitting in the ring, you know, Evander Holyfield, when he basically quit that fight. I think there comes a point where some athletes where they're just like, I'm not feeling this. But it's weird. It's not a natural thing to have in a...
Well, I'm sure they feel that way, but they wait at least until after the game.
Right.
All right, now when you
It'd be great if I walked off your set right now. I'm like, I'm just done with this.
But if you want to sell a book or two, I'd stick it out and fight, Jeff. All right, so in terms of the book, you said this is not like doing a Brett Favre book. This is a different animal altogether. How so?
I mean, a lot of people don't remember the USFL. A lot of people don't know its impact. A lot of people don't know the names. When you tell people Steve Young played in the USFL, a lot of people say, what the hell is the USFL? You know, so it was a labor of love. I fought for about 9 years to even get a book deal for this. I mean, I kept getting rejected and rejected and rejected. I took less money to do this by far. I attached it to the Favre book I did last time. I actually took less money to do Favre, so they would let me do this. It was just intense. It was really intense.
So why, Jeff? And since I've known you, you've talked about this book. Yeah. And you finally wrote this book. And you're like you said, there was a lot of rejection. Listen, you're a guy who's principled and about integrity. And it's a labor of love. You still got to feed that family. You've got to put food on the table. You moved out to California. This is not a cheap place to live. Why was this book and this topic so important to you?
I just thought the USFL was the greatest story nobody knew. I really did. I thought it was just this insane bolt of lightning that came along and lasted 3 years, and the players were like the names were huge, the impact was huge, the stories are insane. I've never written a book with stories this insane before. Never, not even close. It just was this great package. I knew it was a good book. So
Jeff Perlman joins me in studio. He's got a brand new book out. You know, I want to get into some of these stories, but for those who don't remember, and you made this point, how did the USFL first come about? What is the origin story here?
Well, there was a guy, David Dixon, who was a New Orleans art dealer and wealthy. And back in the 60s, he was really pushing for the city of New Orleans to get an NFL team. And the NFL team, the NFL was just denying. And finally, he actually visited with Paul Brown. And he said, former Browns coach and founder, and said, I have this idea for spring football. And Paul Brown's like, that's a great idea. You should do that. But then the Saints came. And he kind of put it off. He still had it in his head, though, when he met with George Allen, the Redskins, former Redskins coach, and he said, I still have this idea. And George Allen's like, he was a very excitable man. You need to do this. Do this now. That is the best idea. Don't even wait a minute. And that was sort of the idea behind it in the basis. We're just going to spring football. The idea was spring football. We're not really going head-to-head with the NFL. It's just another league. You can pay two big-time players, and then we're going to keep it sort of low-key. Two-point conversion, you know, coaches challenge. We're going to draft regionally. So, like, the Philadelphia Stars will be drafting players out of Penn State, out of Pitt primarily. Tampa was drafting Florida State. It was, I honestly believe, a great, really great basic idea.
Well, it was. It was a great idea with some star value and some amazing stories to go along with it. The book is called Football for a Buck. Jeff Perlman is the author. He's in studio. The book is out right now. Now, we're talking about amazing stories, amazing characters. I mean, I'm tempted to go rapid fire and ask you about some of these guys. We're talking Reggie White, Steve Young, Jim Kelly, and someone like Stanley Floyd, who never played a down of college football, but he did race a horse on That's Incredible. Or you and I could start with Greg Fields. Who was Greg Fields?
It's the best. So Greg Fields, you never heard of him, right?
Oh, I know him, yeah.
Oh, you do?
Sure.
Greg Fields played at Grambling, and he was with the Colts as a rookie in 79.
I know of him because of you in the book.
Oh, yeah. Right. No, I meant before this.
Yeah.
79, he's with the Colts. 80, he's in camp with the Falcons. They cut him. He refuses to leave. So they actually bring an armed security guard in to get him out. He leaves. He's signed by the LA Express. 1984, John Hadle is a coach of the Express. John Hadle tells the assistants, we're going to cut Greg. They're like, you just want to be careful when you do this. That's it. You just want to be, nah, I'll be fine, you know. Calls him in. Greg, you've done a good job here, but... And as soon as he says that, Fields reaches back, punches him in the face. Guys come rushing in. I'm going to have to kill you. I'm going to kill you. They hire this guy, Nelson Mercado, who I interviewed. He was Liberace's bodyguard at the time. And they hired him away from Liberace in Las Vegas. I swear to God. And he comes. And now he's the new protector of Greg Fields. And Greg Fields is calling him death threats. He has a gun in his trunk.
Where's Hard Knocks when we need it?
It would be so good.
He punched John Hadle in the face and threatened to kill him.
Yes, threatened to kill him. And he also threatened to kill the defensive coordinator. And he's...
But at that time, how much money are we talking about? What was the salary for a guy like Greg Fields at that time?
Greg Fields was probably making about 60.
Okay.
And not great. I mean, it was okay.
So that's a reason to go. A reason to threaten to kill somebody.
Exactly.
Okay.
So, he starts calling in death threats. The team, they hire Liberace's security guard. He's showing up at practices just staring. Right? He's calling in. He's showing up at games. They put a tracker on his car. And this is the beauty of it all. Everyone knows about this in the US. About it. Big news. But the San Antonio Gunslingers need defensive line help. So they sign Greg Fields. Okay? He shows up and they greet him in helmets and pads as a joke. Like, don't hit us. Okay. The owner of the Gunslingers.
Did he think that was funny?
Yeah, he did, actually.
Okay.
The owner of the Gunslingers is a guy named Clint Mangus. He stopped paying his players. And the Gunslingers were famous because they had a coach with seven fingers who coached from the stands. He'd sit in the stands next to his wife and coach the team. I kid you not.
Best league ever.
It's the best league ever. So they signed Greg Fields. He stops getting paid. 1985. He follows the owner of the team home. He has a baseball bat in his trunk. He pulls up to the guy's house. The owner gets out of the car. He sees Greg Fields. Owner's a little guy. Greg Fields is huge. Greg Fields has a baseball bat. He goes, I see where you live. I know you got money. You better pay me. And he's holding the bat. And the owner goes, wait here. And he goes in his house and he comes back out. I've actually had the number mistaken. I've said 10,000. So he had $17,000 in a paper bag.
In cash.
Gives it to Greg Fields. He's like, are we good? Fields is like, we're good. Now I just want to say, my son Emmett, who actually came to your set once, he and I did a road trip to find Greg Fields because all I had were two addresses.
What the hell's the matter with you?
I'm a horrible
parent. I know you're a journo and all, but are you kidding me?
I know. My son was 9 at the time. I'm like, road trip. He's like, great.
And I was going to crack this joke about, hey, Jeff, what happens when Greg Fields says to you, you pay me, I've got a bat, but now I don't want to make the joke because I don't want him come to find me.
I know.
I'm terrified of this guy.
He's awesome. He's the best.
You found him.
So I had two addresses. We walked throughout San Francisco, knocked on one lockbox. Second house was in the projects of San Francisco. His sister answered the door. I held up a copy of my book, another book. I was like, this is me, blah, blah, blah. She's like, I can give him your phone number. That's all I got. I'm driving home 20 minutes later. Hey, this is Greg. Who's this? I'm like, this is Jeff Perlman. No one's ever been more excited to talk to you. The next day, me, 9-year-old Emmett Perlman, Greg Fields, food court,
you
Sacramento, California.
Emmett to see Greg Fields.
I did. And Greg Fields, we met at a Cold Stone Creamery at a food court in Sacramento at a mall. And he was fantastic. And it was one of the great finds of my life.
And so, I mean, amazing. And I've seen you, you've gone after a lot of people in terms of trying to find them. Mm-hmm. And then you do or you don't. Yeah. And you found this guy and lived up to all the hype. How was he? Was he pretty pleasant?
He was forthright, pleasant, a little bit punch drunk from probably a lot of football, mm-hmm. you know, but great. Confirm the stories, told a lot of stories. It was good.
His book, Scott's an amazing story. Football for a Buck. It's about the USFL. Jeff Perlman's the author. The book is out right now. You should get it. He's in studio. Let's talk LA Express for a minute. Tom Ramsey, the quarterback, mm-hmm. was at a party in Beverly Hills.
Yeah.
Everybody was there, including Hank Aaron. Ramsey walks up to Aaron. He introduces himself. What happened next and what advice did Aaron give to Ramsey?
It was one of the great. So Tom Ramsey's favorite athlete is still Hank Aaron. And Hank Aaron, he's shocked that Hank Aaron knows who he is. And Aaron says, "You got the money, man. You got the effing money. That's what it's all about."
Incredible.
Yeah, it's so good.
Like, how would he even know Tom Ramsey?
I don't even know. He was a quarterback at UCLA. Then later, the LA Express stopped paying players, and they had Steve Young, and they were taking a bus to get the final game in LA Express. You would know the final game in the history of the LA Express at home was at Pierce College because they couldn't
feel. 818 for life, baby.
Have you been to Pierce College?
Let me tell you about Pierce College. So I went to Calabasas High School, and the joke was, I'll put aside all the jokes about being in 13th grade. You were a degenerate if you went to Pierce. No offense, Pierce College. As JUCOs go, it's really well-respected. It's a really good JUCO school. But yes, they practiced there, didn't they?
No.
They played.
They had their final game ever because they were playing at the LA Coliseum, which was a 90,000-seat stadium, and they're drawing about 3,000 by the end. They had a Steve Young poster giveaway day. First 10,000 fans.
That's
first 10,000 fans get Steve Young posters. 7,000 showed up.
Incredible.
So final game is at Pierce College because they can't fill the Coliseum.
Woodland Hills.
Woodland Hills. The bus is driving the team. The bus driver stops and says, "Unless I get my $500, I ain't moving." They pass around a hat. This is crazy. The two quarterbacks that day, Doug Williams, Arizona Outlaws.
Wow.
Steve Young, LA Express. They meet at the end of the game. Doug Williams comes, shakes his hand, says, "What the hell are we doing here?" And that was the last home game in LA Express history.
Jeff Perlman joining us in studio. It's incredible. Now, there might not have been enough money to go around and guys weren't getting paid, but there was more than enough alcohol and drug usage to go around. What was the alcohol consumption and drug use like in the USFL?
Oh, enormous. Enormous. There was a guy in the Birmingham Stallions named Chuck Clanton. He was a safety, came out of Auburn. He told me they played a game in San Antonio. They were a much better team. And he said the night before, like 80% of the team was snorting coke on the plane. And they showed up and they got killed. Then my favorite guy is Richard Johnson, who later played with the Detroit Lions. He was a receiver for the Houston Gamblers. He used to smoke a joint before every game. Like literally that was part of his preparation.
On the way to the game, right?
Yeah, he would be smoking a joint. And that was his thing. And he was a great, he had 110 catches first year. He was great. Well, he had a teammate named Vince Corville, who wasn't as good a receiver. Nice guy. And he sees Richard Johnson smoking joints. And he's like, I don't know, works for him. He's never smoked pot before. He starts smoking a joint before the game. He gets on the field. He's just overcome by paranoia. He doesn't know what's going
no
on.
No way, right? See, I mean, if smoking, and I'm not a guy that bakes, I'm not here to judge, I just don't do it, but I know that paranoia is something that comes along with it. Dude, how could you be playing football, even at that level, if you're paranoid and guys are looking to knock you the hell out?
Well, the
how
same,
do you do that and what the coaches think?
The coaches. So the coaches would, there was one coach who would check on him every game and be like, "You medicated today? Okay, we're good." They would smell, another teammate said he would smell it coming out of his hotel room and be like, "All right, Richard's going to be good today." The other thing they did, they had a offensive line coach named Bob Young, who played for a long time with the Cardinals. And Bob Young didn't just want his guys to use steroids. He insisted, if you do not use steroids,
you're not committed, right?
Not playing on this offensive line.
Wow.
And he would force the guys to use roids.
Jeff Perlman's my guest. The book is called Football for a Buck. It is out right now. Jeff, I want you to just reset this really quickly. It's a labor of love, but you did take less money to do this deal.
Yeah.
Again, so why is this particular project, in case somebody just jumped in right now, why did this mean so much to you? Because you literally have talked about this league and this book for years, and you took less money. In fact, let me put it another way. What did your agent say when you first said that you want to do this book?
So I have a great agent, but he said, I kept bugging him about it. And he said, Jeff, nobody wants an effing USFL book. And I really wanted it. I'll tell you one thing that's funny is when I was a senior in Mayo Pack, New York, my AP English final paper, it could be 20 pages on whatever subject you wanted. And I said, I'm going to do the USFL. My teacher's like, you really want to do the USFL? Seriously? And I handed in 40 pages on the downfall of the USFL. It was called The Downfall of the USFL. I got a B+. I was really pissed off. I'm sure my teacher, is there any way Mr. Height, who was a great teacher, read 40 pages at the end of the school year?
He gave you a B+, maybe so.
Yeah, maybe.
So what happens when you've got people like that that you respect, all right, an AP English teacher, your agent, people you admire, people you respect telling you, dude, this is a bad idea and nobody wants to read this. Why are you telling yourself, oh, no, this is a good idea and I'm going to do this no matter what?
Because it's very easy in life to just do the safe ideas. And if you look at my books, I'm happy about them all. I really am. I enjoyed the process. But what was the risk in writing about Brett Favre or Walter Payton? They were big topics and they were great. I mean, great enjoyment for me. I really mean that. But I've never taken a real risk where I was just putting it out there and seeing what happened. So I just figured to hell with it.
Jeff Perlman joining me in studio. The book is called Football for a Buck. It's about the USFL. As some people know, Donald Trump did play a role in the USFL and in the demise of the USFL. How did he first get involved?
Right, so originally he was supposed to be an owner in 1983 when the league started. He was enlisted as a New York owner. And they have an owner meeting. It's a true story. They have an owner meeting in San Francisco. All the owners are supposed to show. They're waiting for Donald Trump, the New York owner. Nobody even knows who he is. A young guy waiting, waiting. Finally, a phone rings. They put on speaker. Hey, this is Donald. So listen, bad news. Not going to be able to do it. Got a big deal going on somewhere else. Good luck to all of you guys. Okay, click. The owners were horrified because that was a goodbye to their New York franchise. Huh. They ended up getting a guy from Oklahoma named Walter Duncan to own the team. So a year later, in 1980, after the 83 season, the owner of the Generals is selling the team. And Donald Trump, in the lead up, he decides to buy the team. I love the USFL. This is always saying, USFL is great. It's going to be great. I love what they're doing, blah, blah, blah. As soon as he becomes the owner of the Generals, we need to move to fall. Fall's where the action is. If God wanted football in the spring, he wouldn't create baseball. On and on and on. He has a secret meeting with Pete Rozelle, NFL commissioner at the time. And he says to Rozelle, he rents a suite at the pier, Trump does, and asks Rozelle if he'll meet with him. And he says to Rozelle, I don't really care about the USFL. I want an NFL team. What do I have to do to get in the NFL? A true, 100% true story. Wow. Rozelle says, as long as I am the commissioner of the NFL, as long as my heirs are involved with this league, you will never have a team in this league. Trump then pushes with this idea.
Why was that his response at that time?
Just being honest here, because he thought he was a con man.
Yeah.
And he thought he was a, you know, huckster, and he just didn't trust him. Also, what kind of guy throws under the bus his league? I mean, it's like if you start dating someone who cheated on her last boyfriend, you have to ask yourself, is this person going to be loyal to me? You know?
Sure.
So then he pushes this idea, we need to move to fall. We need to move to fall. Fall. And the whole thing is he wants an NFL team. And he thinks there'll be a merger or something. So ultimately, he convinces the other owners by this thing called lying that he has a fall TV deal lined up and the networks are really excited and they're all going to, fall is going to be great. There's millions of dollars, $90 million waiting for us in fall TV because the spring TV deal that the USFL had, it was with ESPN, it was ABC, it was a flawed deal. It wasn't horrible. It was good for a first time league, but it was flawed. Didn't have blackouts in it, among other things. He tells him, I've met with the executives of TV and they're really excited for fall. He starts using his fake publicist, John Barron, which is him disguising his voice. And he calls different reporters. And he says, and this is all documented. I just want to be clear. This is not me with some...
And there really is no fall league at all.
No.
Okay.
So he starts there's no fall TV deal. There's no fall TV deal.
That's what I mean, right.
Yeah. And then he starts calling. And he calls newspapers and he's saying, you know, Mr. Trump is really leading the movement for fall. If you want to talk to him, I can probably set that up.
This is a real thing. This
really
happened.
Yes.
He's pretending to be his own publicist.
Yes.
Okay.
He pretended to be John Barron, and his son's name is Barron now, which makes it even worse. And so he does the fake publicist thing. He pushes this thing to fall. He runs, the NFL commissions a study based on fall. And here's the problem. The LA market went to crap in the USFL. The Chicago market went to super crap. The Washington market went to crap. They moved to Orlando. They needed New York. They needed New York. It was contractually in the USFL television deal. You have to have a team in New York. So you need him. So he is pushing for fall. And finally, he convinces the other owners, we're going to sue the NFL for an antitrust violation. He said that the NFL was monopolizing TV illegally, and we're going to sue them. And he hires Roy Cohen as the attorney. Roy Cohen, famous for the McCarthy era trials. And he tells the other owners, he promises them, I'm going to hire Roy Cohen. They're going to want to settle immediately. This is what he tells them.
How concerned was the NFL about the USFL at that time?
Think about it this way. Herschel Walker went to the USFL.
Sure.
Jim Kelly, Steve Young, Reggie White. They were stealing people left and right.
Right.
So yeah, terrified. In the office, they used to call it the useless in the NFL office. And it's like, yeah, but that was when nothing was going on. All of a sudden, they're signing Craig James and every other guy.
Sure.
So he says, we're going to sue them. We're going to hire Roy Cohen and they're going to settle. Paul Tagliabue has a meeting with all the owners. The NFL owners are freaking out about this lawsuit because they did have a monopoly and they were plotting for to kill the USFL. They literally commissioned a study called something along the lines of how do we kill the USFL? Sure. You know, it's like this thing. Paul Tagliabue, who's going to be the next commissioner, stands up in a meeting and says, if we settle, if we give in, every time someone challenges us from this time out, this time on, we're going to have a weakness. We cannot settle. The trial happens in New York. The other USFL owners are advising Donald Trump not to have this in New York, that other states will be more sympathetic to plaintiffs. Jerry Argovitz, the owner of the Houston Gamblers, is saying, do it in Texas. This is where we should do it. Trump doesn't listen. They want to call a bunch of players and coaches to testify. Trump doesn't listen. Their star witnesses are a drunk Howard Cosell, Al Davis, who testifies on behalf of the USFL, and Donald Trump. And the NFL attorney, Frank Rothman, sees Donald Trump as the greatest gift he's ever been given because Trump goes up there and he's bombastic and he's arrogant and he comes off like a bully. And he made the USFL the bully of this entire thing. Mm. And what the jury ultimately decided at the end, and I interviewed one of the jurors for this, the USFL was right in everything they were saying, but ultimately they were at fault more than the NFL and they gave them a dollar settlement. And here's the best moment of the whole freaking book, in my opinion. Donald Trump is in the courtroom. John Mara from the New York Giants is sitting next to him. They announce the verdict or the settlement, the amount. Mara opens up his wallet, takes out a dollar bill, and hands it to Donald
Trump. Incredible.
It's the biggest middle finger I've ever heard of in pro sports.
The biggest middle finger you've ever heard of in all of sports.
Don't you think?
I want to make sure. No, I started to talk over you. I want to make sure they heard what you just said.
Here's your dollar.
Yes, I do think. Here's your buck. The book is called Football for a Buck. Jeff Perlman is the author. He's in studio. So how do you think all of that might influence Trump's relationship with the NFL right now?
I would say it this way. He tried buying the Baltimore Colts and failed. He had a meeting with Pete Rozelle that failed. He tried suing the NFL and that failed. He tried buying the Buffalo Bills and failed. He tried buying the New England Patriots and failed. He made a weak effort to buy the Dallas Cowboys and failed. When he was an owner in the USFL, he would be on his phone during the national anthem. He'd be doing interviews during the national anthem. I mean, there you go. Like, give me a break. Hmm.
Jeff Perlman joining us. All right, before we go, let me quickly, if there's some reaction either by Twitter or via the phones, and I know there is. I said that I would get to this. Telephone number is toll-free, 1-800-636-8686. All right, so Jeff in SoCal tweets, this USFL book sounds freaking amazing. One thing, though, clones can't read. Can you ask Perlman to make this into a movie for us? Yeah, I could, Jeff, but I won't. All right, keep moving. At SA Sports Honk tweets, great interview. Jeff Perlman always delivers. Wore the San Antonio Gunslingers and their quarterback, Rick Neuheisel. Clinton Mangus was typical. Check is in the mail. Cheapskate. That's somebody from San Antonio. Uh-huh. Brian C60 tweets, wait, pot makes you paranoid? Well, that explains last Friday. Signed, Hawk, medicinal user. All right, let me check really quickly for a phone call. 1-800-636-8686. Let's go to, throw your headphones on really quickly. Okay. And, all right, this guy wants to get a book published. He's written a book and isn't sure how to go about getting it published. He currently lives on the streets, but he's one of our own. He's been calling the show for 20 years. Ira Craig. Ira, you're on with Jeff Perlman. What's up, Ira?
Hey, fellas. How you guys doing today?
Great.
Okay. Hey, Jeff, this is Homeless Book Beggar Guy, as I'm called on Twitter.
Okay.
Now, last year when I was in jail, I wrote a book. It's an autobiography. It's absolutely awesome. I heard some of your content briefly when I was working, and I thought they were talking about my book, so I thought I'd call. But seriously, in all seriousness, I have written a book. I am self-publishing at the point right now because obviously, I'm a first-time author, and I can't really...
Ira, you got to ask the question. What's your question
for
Jeff?
I need help, Jeff. Can I somehow get a hold of you and get your advice and opinion?
Of course. If you email me, and I'm open about this.
Are you sure you want to do this?
100%. ANNGOLD22@gmail.com. I always check it. I'll be happy to hear what you have to say. 100%.
Thank you, buddy.
Yeah, of course.
All right, Ira, you got it. Listen, you're not just an author... Welcome to the jungle, of course. That was Ira. Ira's out on the street right now. He said that when he heard some of those stories from the USFL, he thought that we were talking about his book. Heyo. Jeff, you're not just an author. You're a salesman. You're a showman. If somebody buys your book right now and emails you proof of their order, what will you do in return?
Well, I always send like signed book plates. I have postcards. I have stickers. I always just, you know, to me, it's an interactive experience. You know,
sure.
So I try to get people.
You're great like that.
I'm trying to give it. I do like, I've been sending out a lot of t-shirts. We have these cool San Antonio Gunslinger t-shirts that I ordered. So, you know, I'm happy to happy to partake.
Good. I like it. All right. Thank you. Where would they send that email? To the same address? And keep in mind, you just gave out your email address to, you know, this network now has 200 plus radio stations. We're on TV. We're on satellite. Are you sure you want to give out an email address to some of the knuckleheads who listen to this program?
Yeah, 100%.
You know the show.
I love
sure?
The interactive nature of it all. I really do. It's angold22@gmail.com.
All right. Yeah. So it's angold, right?
Yeah,
22.
Yeah.
angold22@gmail.com. This one is from @PrincePaul3. Does @JeffPerlman think that Vince McMahon can pull off a new football league? Good question. Where do you come out?
I think the Alliance, you know, there are two leagues coming up. And the Alliance, I think, is a much better chance.
Sure.
I think people see Vince McMahon, not always fair, but kind of gimmicky, and the league is going to be gimmicky. I like that the Alliance has Oliver Luck. I like that they have Ebersol. They hired Steve Spurrier, who was the first coach of the Tampa Bay Bandits.
Love that. How can you go wrong with that?
But I bet you agree with this. Like, the thing the USFL did that was a screw-up in hindsight, you're not going to go head-to-head with the NFL and win.
Right.
You're just not. I think if your quarterback gets signed, if you're the quarterback for the Omaha, whatever they are, and he's signed by the 49ers, you issue a press release, you have a press conference, you wish him well, and you celebrate the future stars start here. You know what I mean? And the USFL
yes.
did not do that.
Yes. No, right. They try to go head-to-head. They try to compete.
Right.
Like the CBA. The CBA was fun. Anytime one of their guys made it, it was great, right? Anytime one of their players or coaches made it, it was something to celebrate because they were in there to try to get to the NBA. This book is called Football for a Buck, The Crazy Rise and Crazier Demise of the USFL. It's out right now. Jeff, it seems kind of self-evident, but there are lots of ways to get books these days. If somebody wants to buy this book, how should they do it?
You know, Amazon or your bookstore, Barnes & Noble, all the standard places. And I also recently did a ranking on my website of the top 25 USFL players of all time. I did a countdown.
Tell me about that very quickly.
I had number one, Sam Mills, who I just want to say, Montclair State, Division III.
God, he was great.
Cut by Toronto, cut by Cleveland. The Cleveland coach calls Carl Peterson, GM of the Stars, and says, I got a 5'9 middle linebacker. You're not going to want him, but watch him. And because of the USFL, he became a star. So it was Sam Mills, Kelvin Bryant.
Sure.
Herschel Walker. Bobby Hebert, who on my audio recording, which got sent back, the guy pronounced it Hebert the entire time.
Bobby Hebert.
I mean, seriously.
Hebert was great, wasn't he?
Hebert was great.
I loved Hebert.
He was throwing Anthony Carter.
Uh-huh.
And Jim Kelly was number five.
I love that. Tell me again, you just said one that just slipped my mind. Who was it?
Kelvin Bryant.
Not Kelvin Bryant.
Herschel.
Herschel. Did you talk? How much time have you spent with Herschel? Herschel is, man, he is such a gentleman. He is great.
Zero. He wouldn't talk.
Ah.
He wouldn't talk. There are two main guys I wanted who didn't talk. Trump and Walker.
I can tell you, for instance, that when I first interviewed Herschel, I thought to myself, man, this dude's going to walk in here and it's going to be a problem. He was nothing like I thought. None of these guys are what they appear to. We don't know any of these guys. Herschel was nothing like I thought.
Yeah.
Total gentleman.
Yeah, and a legend. I mean, he was the most important figure in the USFL.
Right, sure he was.
He was the one who started it all.